Well, last week on The Debate, climate did make a brief appearance, mainly as policy rather than science. So let us this week summarise some of the evidence and the criticisms. Here's Tony Eggleton, who's Professor Emeritus at the Australian National University in Canberra. He's a mineralogist, a geologist, and has been struck almost literally by the violent weather we've had in recent times. Only this week, ferocious winds have brought down trees in New South Wales. Tony Eggleton's new book is called simply A Short Introduction to Climate Change.
The Australia-wide heatwave of January had people asking, is global warming to blame? Not for the first time had this question arisen. The Queensland floods of 2011 and again at the end of January, New York's Superstorm Sandy, the ongoing drought in America, all were weather events that prompted that question. The word here is attribution. What can be attributed to global warming? The meteorologist's answer is no particular event can be attributed specifically to global warming, but all weather is affected by it. Let's look first at the recent heatwave. The comments of an old-time resident of Alice Springs interviewed on the TV news were along the lines of, we've had hot spells before, it's a cyclical thing. Well, yes, we have had hot spells before, but is it a cyclical thing? Were those earlier heat waves as hot? Were they as long? In other words, is this just natural variation in the weather from year to year, or is it a change resulting from global warming? Two hypotheses very well suited by analysis with Occam's razor. Which hypothesis demands the fewest assumptions? Before we can investigate this, we need to decide on what we mean by natural variation. 55 million years ago, the global temperature was about 12 degrees warmer than today. 25,000 years ago, it was about 6 degrees cooler than today. These changes were large, but took place much more slowly than today's rate of warming. They are outside any experience we might have of natural variation in climate, and so are not relevant to this particular issue. Closer to our time, the so-called medieval warm period saw temperatures in the countries around the northern Atlantic as much as 1 degree warmer than the 1950 global average, while at the same time Australia, South America and Siberia were of the order of half a degree cooler than that average. Globally, the temperature was little different from the mid-20th century. But the fact is, there is insufficient evidence to compare a long hot spell today with anything pre-1910, so I plan to consider the climate since that date, the date the Australian Bureau of Meteorology regards as the beginning of reliable records. Climate is said to be the average of the weather over a long period. 30 years is commonly used. On this basis, I took as my measure of climate the number of summer days when Alice Springs had a daily maximum above 40 degrees, averaged over the previous 30 years. From 1910 to 1940, the average was 7 days above 40 degrees. From 1950 to 1980, the average was 11. Over the last 30 years, it was close to 15. Not only is this measure of heat waves rising, it is doing so linearly with, for the statisticians, an R-squared value of 0.95. Furthermore, there is no trace I can see of a cycle or any other pattern in the temperatures. Some years have more hot days than others, and that's about all. To accept that these records lie within natural variation, you must assume that such a steady rise in temperature was happening, unfortunately unrecorded, in the 19th and 18th centuries. Unsubstantiated assumptions are not what William of Ockham was talking about. Let's assume the increase in the number of hot days at Alice Springs is related to global warming. The mean annual temperature at Alice Springs has risen by 1 degree in 60 years. 60 years ago, Alice Springs experienced, on average, 15 days of summer over 39 degrees. Today it averages 15 days over 40 degrees. One substantiated assumption. This century has seen three prolonged droughts, around 1900, in the early 1940s, and the recent drought that ended in 2010. During the last long drought, the University of Melbourne's Professor David Caroli and two colleagues concluded, "This is the first drought in Australia where the impact of human-induced global warming can be clearly observed." Critics replied that drought in Australia is part of our normal climate variation. Certainly, droughts are part of our natural climate variation. Many related to the natural variation in the Southern Oscillation Index, El Niño-La Niña. But the intensity and duration of this drought was a consequence of unnatural global warming. In my book on climate change, I drew attention to several natural phenomena that have reacted to rising global temperatures, such as earlier spring emergence of butterflies or a shift in the date of European grape harvest. A recent study led by Dr. Leanne Webb at the University of Melbourne and CSIRO found that Australian grape harvests have been getting earlier at the rate of a few days a decade since 1940, accelerating over the last 20 years to almost one day a year earlier. The critical words in Professor Caroli's conclusion, applicable to all these observations, are human-induced. The time of grape harvest, the droughts, the rising temperatures, the heat waves, all are incontrovertible observations. Human-induced is an interpretation based on other observations, such as the rising atmospheric carbon dioxide content, known emissions from fossil fuel types, and the isotopic composition of the CO2. To these are added some well-known laws of physics. The only assumption needed to draw Caroli's conclusion is that greenhouse gases warm the Earth and the laws of physics work in Australia. The assumptions needed by those who deny the presence of global warming and its impact are that the observations are fallacious and that physics has been suspended. The other significant weather events that might be attributed to climate change involve rain. To a climate scientist, an extreme rainfall event fits smoothly into the expectations of the consequences of global warming. To some others, the Premier of New South Wales, Barry O'Farrell, for one, it is natural variability again. He remarked of the floods at the end of January this year, "Let's not turn this near disaster, this episode that has damaged so many properties and other things, farm properties and other things, into some politically correct debate about climate change. Give me a break." On the contrary, Premier O'Farrell, you don't need a break, you need to wake up. Warmer air can hold more water vapour. That is why the tropics are humid and the Antarctic is not. The rise in global temperature has done two important things to storms developed over the oceans. The warmer ocean water gives more energy to the storm system, and the warmer air allows the storm to carry more water. The inevitable result of that is stronger winds and heavier rains. No unnecessary assumptions in this, it is physics again. Storms are a part of the natural weather system. More violent storms are part of climate change. It seems to me that many of our politicians, largely on the right, do not get it. And one reason they don't is surely that they must be listening to a litany of lies and misinformation by a few vociferous former scientists and bloggers who are collectively in denial about climate change. It is very revealing to examine the history of climate change denial. When it first appeared, denial was largely directed toward debunking the evidence for global warming, evidence which had been derived from analysis of worldwide meteorological station temperature measurements. The assumption of those in denial was that in the 19th century, met stations were in quiet country villages, but by now these villages have grown to be hot cities. Any evidence of warming is simply evidence of urban heat. The argument went that the measurements are unreliable and global warming was not happening. Eventually, this denial was itself debunked by a group of their own, skeptical physicists and statisticians from Berkeley University, who reassessed all the temperature data using their own superior expertise and came up with exactly the same result as the climate scientists had. Global warming is real. Any grapevine could have told them that. For a period, the self-styled sceptics denied that atmospheric carbon dioxide levels were increasing, denying that modern analytical methods were as good as those of the 19th and early 20th centuries, and claiming on this basis that CO2 levels had been up beyond the 400 parts per million levels back in 1940 and 1890 and earlier. There is now worldwide coverage of atmospheric carbon dioxide measurements, and the steady rise is incontrovertible. Denial has gone quiet on this now. Unable to argue that carbon dioxide levels were not increasing, next they denied that the carbon dioxide came from fossil fuels. It must come from volcanoes, undetected by volcanologists, unfortunately. Or it came out of the ocean. Of course, quite a lot had been coming from the ocean as it warmed after the last glaciation. Levels went from 160 parts per million to 280. That emission slowed and stopped about 8,000 years ago, after which the world cooled very slowly by about 2 degrees. But using faulty statistics, some purported to demonstrate that the CO2 increase in the last 250 years came from the ocean anyway, despite there being no known mechanism for this. More recently, the deniers shifted ground again to argue that global warming has stopped and temperatures have been steady since 1998. For this, they are basing their argument on the very measurements of temperature that a few years ago they declared were fallacious. In a breathtaking change of position, now these same people who said no to rising temperatures, no to rising carbon dioxide, no to fossil fuel-sourced carbon dioxide, no to it having any impact on global temperatures anyway, have done an about-turn. All these things are happening after all, and they are good for you and good for the planet. More people die from cold, they argue, than from heat, so warming the planet is healthy. Crops grow faster and bigger and better under a high carbon dioxide atmosphere, so burning fossil fuels will help feed Earth's ever-increasing population. No matter what the vast majority of climate and Earth scientists conclude, these few persistent speakers, bloggers and unrefereed authors will contradict. They have formed, for whatever reason, an industry of denial, with no regard for the science whatsoever. Again, Occam's razor can cut through the nonsense. Agriculture, society and civilization developed after the end of the last ice age, during those 8,000 years when the global climate was essentially steady. What we are has been made under that climate. The 12-degree temperature rise of 55 million years ago caused widespread species extinction, and that rise was much slower than today's. To declare that global warming will be beneficial piles unsubstantiated assumption upon assumption and ignores all we know about past climate change. Of the few crops that have been tested under high levels of carbon dioxide, some become more productive, some less. Some are more drought tolerant, some are less nutritious, some are more susceptible to insect attack. On the other hand, to run an uncontrolled experiment on the climate of our only habitable planet demands but one assumption, that we are all mad.
Well, are we? Emeritus Professor Tony Eagleton is at the ANU in Canberra. His book is called A Short Introduction to Climate Change, and it's published by Cambridge. Next week, we turn to patents. I'm Robin Williams.